Are you ready? You don't look ready.
The CMU podcast, in association with 7 Digital.
This week, publishers v America, audio v video, and Spotify v Apple. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. My co-host is Chris Cook, number 10 on the CMU website bylines list.
I don't understand what that means.
Because there are two Chris's in our bylines, I just type you in as number 10. I now just think of you as number 10, so I do remember your name then.
So this is a little bit of CMU website content management system secrets that you're sharing
behind
with
scenes,
the listeners.
Chris is number 10.
That's because Chris Carey wrote us a column once.
Yeah.
Now every time you type in Chris into the byline in the CMU website field for writer, his name comes up before my name.
That's
because he wrote an article once.
Yeah.
Once he wrote an article. It was in the CMU Trends section of the site, so only our premium subscribers can even read the article that Chris Carey wrote.
Waste of time.
Based on his Great Escape presentation. Not this year, last year.
Yes.
Can I also say,
What?
Well done on the intro.
Thanks.
Although because last week we didn't have a proper podcast, we had a very good podcast. If you haven't listened to my interview with David Larry, it's very good. I'm saying that because he was very good. I'm not just bigging myself up there.
You are really though, aren't you?
Well, my questions were very good, it has to be said, but his answers were also good.
They were good.
So we both delivered on last week's podcast, which means that we didn't have a usual chit-chat podcast last week.
Yeah. Is that what this is?
This is a chit-chat podcast.
Right.
Therefore, I think at least one of the stories we're going to talk about in today's podcast is from the last 14 days in music.
Oh, what? So you're saying now I've come up with a snappy tagline.
It's inaccurate.
It's an inaccurate... Oh.
So it's the last 2 weeks.
Well,
in
it carried
music.
Over, doesn't it? I mean, they all carry over. It's all an ongoing thing in life, you know. Things still happened in the last 7 days. They might have also happened in the last 14 days.
In the last 2 weeks since we last sat in this room doing a podcast
for
the CMU audience, not a lot has happened the last 2 weeks, has it? It's been a pretty uneventful 2 weeks. In the world of news.
Well, it depends on how you look at it, because I'd say there's a few big things have happened, but it was there wasn't a very long list of stories for this week.
Yes, there hasn't been much music business news in the last fortnight. There's been a hell of a lot of news.
Yeah.
If only we were here to talk about the news in general, we would need about 92 hours to discuss what has happened, mainly in the United Kingdom in the last 14 days. But that is not what we're here to talk about.
No, thankfully, because I've sort of now got myself to a point where I can not just talk about it endlessly.
So we're not going to talk about Brexit.
No.
We're not going to talk about that on this edition of the podcast. We're not going to talk about...
Aren't we? Let me just have a...
Have you got some...
Yeah, there is actually a bit.
Brexit nuggets.
Yeah.
Oh, that, now, I'm being inaccurate on the introduction.
Oh, well,
to
that's
the podcast.
One each.
So we might mention some Brexit stuff. Now I'm curious as to what the hell we're going to talk about with regard to Brexit.
Well, we'll see, won't we?
Do you know, I managed to get until about 4 weeks ago without using the word Brexit.
Yeah, it's one of those things, isn't it?
I managed to avoid using it because it's such a horrible word. And now it's just like... It's so part of everyday speech now. It's impossible to not use it. I think that's almost the worst...
the worst thing about this.
About the result of the referendum is that now we're all using the word Brexit. Of course, there was the Chilcot report yesterday. We're not here to talk about that.
No.
Either. What other big events have happened in the last fortnight which are not music?
There was some football.
There was some football.
And something happened.
Well, some teams won and some teams lost.
That's true.
Needless
I believe
to say,
that to be true.
England lost. It always amuses me. Obviously, we don't follow football. Don't really understand, but it never ceases to amuse me how every time one of these big competition comes along, all of my English friends who are football people, follow football, that is to say, they all seem convinced that this could be the time, even though, as far as I'm aware, other than in 1966, when England won the World Cup, because it took place in England...
Well, that can't be the only reason.
Well, I know, but it helps when you're playing on home turf, doesn't it, to a home fan base. Other than that, I don't think England have ever won anything at all. So why every time do all the football fans of England think this will be the time?
Well, you've got to have hope, haven't you? I mean, we all thought we were going to stay in the EU.
Yes, and that hope didn't turn out justified, did it?
All our hopes are dashed. Let's talk about the music business.
Hey, I want to talk about my trip to Barbados.
No, I don't want to talk about your trip
Let's
to Barbados.
That was
a brilliant segue.
That's the other thing that happened in the last fortnight.
I don't care about
I
your
met
trip
the
to
music
Barbados.
Community of Barbados, and they were great. And I must say thank you to everybody who made me so welcome there. It was a very nice trip. and especially to Steve, who runs the main record company and distributor in the Caribbean region, who gave up his whole Saturday to drive me around the island, around Barbados.
Did that take a whole Saturday?
It did. Yeah, it pretty much. We left the hotel at 10 and I didn't get back till 6. Well, the sun goes down at 6 in Barbados. So there's not much point doing anything after that. So, yeah, it was a very nice time. Thank you to the people of Barbados. I'm happy to come whenever you want me to come and talk about the music industry and copyright and the digital market. I'm here waiting for the call. So, yeah, I had a very good fortnight, even if everyone else had a bit of a rubbish fortnight. But there you go. What was your segue?
I said, all our hopes are dashed. Let's talk about the music business. Speaking of hopes dashed, in fact, the publishers of the United States of America, their hopes have all been dashed upon the rocks of the US Department of Justice. That's what's happened this week.
I'm trying to picture that happening there. Picturing the Department of Justice as an island off the coast. Obviously, I know what islands off the coast of the North American subcontinent look like, so I can imagine the old hopes of the publishers being smashed on the cliffs. This is consent decree.
It is.
Quite brave putting consent decree news first in the podcast if we're hoping to keep everybody for the full edition.
Keep listening. This is interesting stuff. We've talked about consent decrees before.
We have a few people thought that my description of the consent decrees during the David Lowery interview was very good. Unfortunately, I can't remember what it was. So perhaps if everything I'm about to say doesn't make sense, go back and listen to me and David Lowery talking about consent decrees on last week's podcast, because apparently then I cracked it in describing what this is.
Well, it's, the consent decrees basically govern what ASCAP and BMI can and can't do.
It is the regulation of collective licensing in the US. So obviously sometimes in the music industry, rather than record companies all doing separate deals with licensees and then music publishers all doing separate deals, all the rights owners get together. Usually the labels and the publishers do this separately. Imagine the entire music industry working as one. Actually, in Barbados, they do, as it happens. The society in Barbados is both recording rights and publishing rights. But anyway, collective licensing is a thing. It's where all the labels get together and appoint a collecting society to license on their behalf. And it's where all the publishers get together and appoint a society to represent their rights on their behalf. So it means as a radio station, for example, radio is always licensed through the collective licensing system. As a radio station, rather than going to have to do deals with every single music publisher in the world, you can go to one organisation in each country. So in the UK, that's PRS, and get one license. And that basically covers all of the songs that you would ever want to play on your radio station. So on one level, collective licensing is great. It's great for the licensee. They only need one deal. In some ways, it's great for the rights owners. It means they only have to do one deal. They don't have to do the admin and the legal on hundreds of deals. Also, everyone gets paid the same. That's one of the upsides of collective licensing. It doesn't matter if you're a superstar artist or a tiny little unsigned band. If you get daytime play on Radio 2, you earn the same chunk of money for each play that you get. So on one level, collective licensing is good for everybody.
But it's anti-competitive, isn't it?
But competition law doesn't like collective licensing. The idea of all of the music publishers getting together and licensing as one, that sounds a bit like a monopoly. And so as a result of that, usually, it varies greatly from country to country, but in a lot of countries, within copyright law, you'll find a chunk of extra regulation that applies to collective licensing. So in the UK, when PRS are doing the licensing for the publishers or PPL are doing it for the record companies, the minute it's collective licensing, there are extra rules and regulations, the most important of which is if the licensees can't reach a deal with the society. Whereas if you can't reach a deal with a record company or an individual publisher, then the label or the publisher can just say, well, screw you. You can't use my music. We're walking away from the negotiating table. Whereas with collective licensing, you lose the right to do that. And ultimately, it can go to a court and a judge will decide what the licensee is going to pay. So collective licensing happens in most countries. It's very common for collective licensing to have extra regulation. But the US, as always,
It's
a little bit different. For starters, there are multiple collecting societies all representing the same kinds of rights. So here in the UK, when it comes to the performing rights in songs, it's always PRS. Okay, actually, in Wales, there is a separate society for Welsh language, but for English language music in the UK, PRS licensed the performing rights of songs. Whereas in the US, we have the two you mentioned, ASCAP and BMI, and then there are two much smaller societies.
CSAC and GMR.
Global Music Rights. And as a songwriter, you have to decide which of those societies is going to represent your performing rights. And as a licensee, you need to get licenses from all four if you want to use songs in all four's repertoire. And as far as the regulation is concerned, concern, it is BMI and ASCAP as the big societies that are regulated. But rather than those regulations sitting in copyright law, there are these things called consent decrees, which the Department of Justice negotiated with both BMI and ASCAP, I mean, way back in the early 20th century. And so these are the documents that regulate the societies. And in recent years, the big music publishers in particular have been saying, do you know what? These consent decrees were predominantly written in the mid-20th century or early 20th century in some cases, and they just don't work in the digital age. It's time they were rewritten. And then a couple of years ago, good news, the Department of Justice said, all right then, let's have a look at these consent decrees and work out whether or not we should change them. And so ever since then, the societies and the publishers and their trade body and the songwriters have all been calling for changes to be made to these consent decrees.
And what they specifically wanted was to be allowed to partially withdraw their rights, because that's not currently allowed. And they wanted to do that so that they could do direct deals with digital services and therefore try to get better rates for them while still having their rights collectively represented for, like, bars, radio, stuff like that, rather than the current rules, which they went to court over and a judge said, no, you're either in or out. So if you withdraw to do direct deals with digital services, you then have to do direct deals with every bar that plays music in the whole of the US.
Which would be a lot of deals.
It would be a bit of a pain in the arse.
So in Europe, that partial withdrawal has been allowed. The consent decrees were actually a little bit vague on this. So at one point, Sony ATV and Universal said to Pandora, this all came to a head with big bad Pandora. Actually, as David Larry said on last week's podcast, perhaps Pandora isn't as big and bad as it used to be. Well, it's still big, but Pandora has been a lot more flexible with rights owners in the last year or so. But a few years ago, Pandora licensed all of its recording rights through Sound Exchange, its publishing rights through BMI and ASCAP. They put a lot of effort into trying to get the rates they pay down. And in order to try and stop that, the big publishers said, right, that's it. We're not going to license Pandora through the collecting societies anymore because you keep taking it to the rate courts, which is the court that rules on collective licensing where people can't agree on rates. You keep getting the rates down in the rate courts. So we'll force you into direct deals. We'll get better rates. That's great. And Pandora for a time thought that might happen and had actually done the deals. But at the same time, Pandora went to the rate courts and said, we don't think the publisher should be allowed to do this. And the rate court said, you're right. And so, yes, so they can't do partial withdrawal. And so there was various things they were hoping to change on the consent decrees. But I think it's fair to say that that was pretty much at the top of their agenda. And about a year ago, when they were about halfway into this review, rumours were coming out from the people who were talking to the Department of Justice division that is overseeing the consent decrees. The word was that they were seriously considering making that change and allowing partial withdrawal. But BMI and ASCAP went in for a meeting last week, I think, with the relevant department in the Department of Justice to find out what the big plan was.
Good news, we're going to make no changes. So well done on all that lobbying and all the work that everyone's done here.
Yes, so the Department of Justice.
There's no need to change anything. And they also said there is one thing, this thing 100% licensing, we've decided that the consent decrees say that that is a thing that you should be doing, and so you should be doing that.
Yeah, this was double bad news for the publishers because they did not want 100% licensing. They wanted lots of other stuff. They didn't get the other stuff. What they've ended up with is 100% licensing. So when the consent decree review began, the publishers went in with all the changes they wanted, partial withdrawals at the top of their list. And then again, I think it was about a year ago, maybe slightly longer ago, the publishers started saying, oh my God, the Department of Justice have put this whole extra thing on the agenda, which we haven't asked for, which is to answer the question, is 100% licensing possible under the collective licensing system in the US? So this isn't actually the Department of Justice adding an extra line to the consent decree. It's merely them interpreting what the consent decree already says. I suppose, like what happened with partial withdrawal in the rate courts, although this time it's the Department of Justice saying it. So what is 100% licensing? Well, lots of songs are co-written and therefore co-owned. And lots of songwriters in the US work together who are in different collecting societies. So you'll have a BMI member collaborating with an ASCAP member, collaborating with a CSAC member, collaborating with a GMR member. So let's imagine that there are four songwriters collaborating on a song and they each therefore own the copyright. They each have a stake in the copyright, but they all happen to be in different collecting societies. And the understanding has always been in the US that if you wanted to use that song on your radio station, say, you actually needed a license from all four societies so that all of the bits of the copyright were covered. So let's say it was split four ways. So each 25% chunk was covered, and then you would pay 25% of the royalties due to each of the societies, who would then pass it on to the relevant songwriters and probably split to the publishers as well. However, this is another way in which US copyright law is different to nearly everywhere else in the world. In the outside of collective licensing, in America, technically speaking, where you have a co-owned work, any one of those owners can do a deal. So here in the UK, say you wanted to license the use of a song for an advert and you were doing a sync deal. Let's say there were four owners again. They'd probably all be PRS members in the UK. But with a sync deal, you're not doing it for collective licensing system. So you're doing direct deals with the songwriters and probably their publishers. And the principle is, if there are four owners, then you have to go and do deals with each of them. And any one of them can say no. Any one of them can screw up the entire deal. And it might be that one of the songwriters only owns 2% of the song, but they can still say no, I'm not going to do the deal, or ask for loads of money for their 2%.
And you can't just cut off 2% of the song.
You can't work out what
they
it was.
They thought of that.
Well, I suppose if they'd specifically done a bit of the score that you could take out, create a new work, perhaps there is a little get out there. But
please write in, lawyers.
Crucially, in the US, the basic rule for direct licensing is that any one of those songwriters could actually do the deal on behalf of all of the other co-owners without asking the other co-owners, on the condition that they then share the money pro rata based on how much of the copyright they own. Okay, and that's called 100% licensing, or it's sometimes called whole licensing, and the opposite is fractional licensing. Fractional licensing being where you have to go and do separate deals with everybody to get their fraction of the copyright secure. So the basic principle in the US is that you can get 100% licensing. That's the default rule. Except that outside of collective licensing, although in theory 100% licensing should be possible, contracts between songwriters generally mean that you can't get 100% license on a co-owned work, because when songwriters collaborate, they will usually through contract agree that they will never do a 100% license deal on that song. So in reality, if you're doing sync licensing in the US, although in theory any one songwriter slash publisher should be able to give you 100% of a co-owned song, invariably those deals aren't available. So that's how it works on the direct licensing side. The question is, what about collective licensing? And what happened once this review got underway is that some of the licensees, I think it was mainly coming from the broadcasters, said, well, the default rule under American copyright law is that 100% licensing is possible. Okay, perhaps in direct licensing, contracts are circumventing that, but the basic rule is that you can do 100% licensing. Surely that should also apply to collective licensing. Except BMI and ASCAP, and the publishers, and those songwriters who follow these things, all insist that no, it is not a rule in collective licensing. It never has been. In collective licensing, it's fractional licensing. If you are playing a co-owned work, then you need to go and get your deals from each of the societies that have a stake in that song. So that was what the societies were saying. And it was interesting. The music publishers went into this review feeling quite bullish. They were leading the agenda. We want partial licensing. There's some other changes we want too. And then from about halfway through, then suddenly we're on the backtrack. And rather than them leading, it was like, oh my God, we've opened up this review and now they're going to force 100% licensing on us. And as I say, it's not actually that they're rewriting the consent decrees. It's merely the Department of Justice saying, in their opinion, it was always that way. And it was just that the societies hadn't been complying with what they should have been doing under the consent decrees as it was written. So this is what the Department of Justice told BMI and ASCAP at a meeting last week. It isn't a final decision. BMI and ASCAP could as yet choose to fight this. Also, any changes to the consent decree need to go before the rate court, although actually I've just said it's technically not a change to the consent decree. I don't know about a reinterpretation. But either way, the rate courts have to rubber stamp this conclusion. So I think the publishers will probably have another opportunity to argue against this. Also, what we've been told is that the Department of Justice have told the publishers that they'll have at least a year to comply with this new interpretation of the consent decrees. But I think what was clear, once BMI and ASCAP were sharing this information with the publishers and the songwriters, is nobody in music publishing. It's another thing that's uniting everybody. Yeah. No songwriter, no publisher, whether major or indie, BMI or ASCAP members, no one is happy with this.
No, we've had a lot of statements this week saying, oh, don't know about this one, guys.
So the boss of Sony ATV and the boss of Universal Music Publishing and the boss of Warner Chappell have all put out statements in one form or another. and all basically saying this is terrible news. This is not how they have interpreted the consent decrees in the past. It will cause all sorts of administrative headaches. They're also saying it might make, say, songwriters who are in ASCAP nervous of working with songwriters who are in BMI, because it would mean that their society would lose the right to control the licensing of that song in the collective licensing scenario. I don't know from a licensee's perspective. I imagine there are enough songs which are entirely controlled by ASCAP or entirely controlled by BMI, either because they're written by one person or because they are written by collaborators who happen to be in the same society. I imagine there's enough songs that those two societies control outright that not many people are going to say, well, we'll just go with a BMI license and then get a whole load of ASCAP songs through 100% licensing. But perhaps I'm wrong. I mean, I think for radio, you would still need both licenses. But perhaps for playing music in store, where you don't necessarily need access to a complete repertoire of content, perhaps people could just do it all on a BMI license. I can't quite work out whether this is good news or bad news for the smaller societies, for CSAC and GMR.
Well, GMR being a small collecting society with some big songwriters, they don't actually, I think, have that many songs that they own 100% outright. Because
yeah,
most of their songwriters, like Pharrell, their big name, isn't it, are often co-writers. And their co-writers are more likely to be part of another society because GMR doesn't have that many clients.
Yeah, GMR was only set up a couple of years ago, mainly to get better rates out of digital services and particularly YouTube. Now, the smaller societies are not subject to consent decree, which means that therefore their deals don't go before rate court. So in some ways, you could say the fact that the big societies aren't allowed partial withdrawal makes joining a CSAC or a global music rights more attractive, because there they have more control over the digital deals that they do because they're not subject to a rate court intervention. Although the 100% licensing thing means that any songs which are co-controlled by BMI and ASCAP, people could get under BMI and ASCAP licenses anyway. So maybe good news or bad news for CSAC or global music rights. Although one lawyer we spoke to who came to this from totally the other side of the debate, he represents predominantly broadcasters, he was saying that if CSAC gets too big, well, actually he thinks that it's pretty much at this point already, and I don't know about global music rights if they have plans to expand, but if those societies get too big, then there will be grounds for saying, well, now these guys are so big, they should be regulated through consent decrees, and so then you're back to square one. But anyway, no one in the music side is happy on this. This week, it remains to be seen whether or not there is room for fighting back, or whether the future of collective licensing in the US is 100% licensing and no partial withdrawal. And if that is the future, then the next question is, well, will the big songwriters and the big publishers go through with what I suppose is a nuclear option here, which is to pull from collective licensing entirely? As you said, I mean, who wants to be licensing every single bar, cafe, shop in America? But having said that, in the digital age, it's getting easier to do those deals. Certainly with radio, it would be easier to do those deals. So where there isn't a compulsory license that forces collective licensing, could they just pull completely and move to direct licensing moving forward? Quite what that would mean for songwriters who are in like a PRS in the UK, but who get their royalties from the US through the reciprocal agreements between BMI, ASCAP and PRS, God knows. But we'll be interested to see what happens with all of this over there in the US. Okay, after all of that consent decree chatter, and given that we are only actually covering three major stories on this podcast, whereas normally we cover four,
yeah,
but we decided to go with three this week for very important strategic reasons that we don't feel that we need to share. Also, not a lot's happened, given that we're not here to talk about
Brexit. We said that earlier, so we could have just stuck with that.
And the Chilcot Report. So let's do CMU approved now, even though it's a bit earlier in the podcast than we would usually do it, because, you know, I haven't been having any verbal approving from Andy Malt for a fortnight now. So we need to get some verbal approving underway. So let's start off with Will Joseph Cook.
Why don't we do that? Yes.
One of your approved artists.
Will Joseph Cook. Yes. He.
No relation, in case you wondered.
Well, his name's spelled differently.
It's not my brother or my cousin or my uncle.
Could be a distant relation.
Because he doesn't have an E on his Cook. He doesn't spell Cook right.
His family might have dropped it when they wanted to distance themselves from yours.
So that's what happened.
Not sure this is important. Will Joseph Cook. He is signed to Atlantic last year after having a bit of indie success. And what good is indie success if you aren't then signed to a major? That's
controversial
that's
statement.
That's my view. He's a singer-songwriter, but he has very upbeat poppy songs that would suit a major label, but they're very good upbeat poppy songs. Hence, he's been approved here with his new single, Take Me Dancing, which has just been released. I assume that he's building up to an album. He's released two singles this year, both of which have very good videos. And I believe both of the videos are in the approved article. So go and watch them both and enjoy them because they're good.
Second approved this week is Tycho.
Yeah, Tycho, who recently marked the end of a two-year cycle of promoting his last album, Awake, by releasing a brief documentary about that album called Closing the Chapter, which seemed pretty final. And then he opened the next chapter the very next day, releasing a new single called Division, which sticks within the mould of his sound. It's electronic.
Except it's a new chapter, remember.
It's a new chapter, but it's definitely him still doing this music. But it's good because I'm happy to hear more music in that mould, which is kind of electronic music. I mean, I think he talks about in interviews, he liked electronic music and he started making electronic music, but he found it didn't have the kind of warm heart that he wanted it to. So he started bringing in other more live instruments, but still keeping it with an electronic feel. This new track, Division, fits within that mould and it's really good. And I guess it's the sign of where he's heading, which is down the same road he was on before.
So there you go.
That's good.
Good approving here. Let's move on to... is this Miami Go? Is that how we're saying this?
I was saying that in my head initially until I realised that it's probably Mi Amigo.
Actually,
but it could be Miami Go.
Do you know what? When I proofed this, that is actually how I read it in my head.
Maybe. So, maybe the lack of a space is the ambiguity they were going for.
No, I think... Yeah, I was with you even though I wasn't with you, and now I'm back with you.
Well, anyway, Mi Amigo or Miami Go, they're from Brighton, so it's neither, unless they plan to go to Miami. We'll have to ask them, but there's not time now. They got a new single out called Forever. They're all very poppy also, and they've been putting out music for a couple of years now. This track is the first with a proper video. They've made a couple of very homemade videos now, but this is a proper sleek-looking video, which would suggest that they're stepping up their game a bit.
I thought someone's giving them some cash.
Well, which would also be an indicator of them stepping things up a bit.
I wonder who's giving them some cash.
They write quite... dark tales in an 80s pop mode, which is always worth listening to.
I wonder what cash giver likes that kind of music. Mysteries as yet to be solved. And finally this week on CMU Approved, Riz MC is back.
A CMU favourite, are we allowed to call him that?
Yeah.
I know we don't really call people CMU favourites
anymore.
It
used to be one of our things. And then you took it away.
Yeah, but I'm bringing it back.
I'm looking forward to referring to people as CMU favourites again.
No, I'm taking it back again. Riz MC, who we've been writing about in CMU for a long, long time.
As both a musician and occasionally we mention his acting, even though that's not really our remit.
Yeah, he released a new mixtape at the end of May called Inglistan, which is broadly about multiculturalism in the UK, as this track Inglistan is also about. It's the opening track of the mixtape, and it sums up, I guess, the content that's going to come through the whole album. And
written before the EU
written
referendum.
Before the EU
when
referendum,
everyone went racist for some
but
reason.
But he's made a video for it in the wake of the referendum, and so it kind of broadly covers both sides of the disaster that happened 2 weeks ago.
So the lyrics predate... the Brexit.
But I think it's interesting.
The video incorporates the madness that has ensued since.
Yes. And I mean, I think it's interesting that, and I say this in the arc, this has sort of been the theme that's run throughout his career as a rapper. And his first big track was Post 9/11 Blues, which is sort of a jaunty, jokey, sarcastic, satirical take on being a Muslim in Britain, then in 2006. And now this year, the Inglistan, this is a much more somber look at it. Although it's not without the closing track of the EP takes on a very biting, satirical take. So do go and listen to the whole thing.
Go listen to the whole thing.
It's very good.
I'd listen to the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's what I would do.
Yeah.
CompleteMusicUpdate.com/approved for more of this nonsense. Go and read and enjoy.
Okay, let's go back to the US again for some digital stats. Who doesn't love a few digital stats?
This is a new report put out by an organisation called Buzz Angle.
Yeah.
Looking at what has been buzzing and angling in digital music in America for the first 6 months of this year. So the stats up till the end of June. So they got them out quite quickly.
They got them out very
given it's only recently been the end of June. Looking at how different sorts of digital music and actually other music sales have been going as well. So they've aggregated data from various different places. Some interesting stats in this. Never entirely sure with reports like this just how comprehensive their stats are versus the figures that come out from the trade bodies at the end of the year, which pull in statistics from all of the labels.
But at this halfway point in the year, we've got some stats to look at, so that's fun.
And tell us some of the standout conclusions of this report, which has actually been very widely reported. I mean, these guys have put out reports before, but I think this one in particular was picked up by a lot more press.
Well, I think
perhaps because of one of the headline stats that they were pushing
forward. Well, there were various headline stats that people
have been
pulling.
You can't have more than one headline.
All right. There are various big stats that people have been pulling out in order to make headlines.
Yes.
One of them...
So various potential headlines.
Yes.
You can have lots of potential headlines, but just one headline.
But you want just one of them, you're going to keep interrupting.
I think is my point. I'm looking forward to it. Tell me what you think is the headline stat. I'm not interested in the potential headline stats. I want to know what you, Andy Malt, editor of CMU, think is the headline stat from this pack of stats goodness.
Well, one of them... I think is interesting. In
you
seem
to be hedging your bets again.
I'm not hedging my bets.
The headline stat is...
I'm going to give it to you.
The undeniable...
I'm not sure I can be bothered anymore.
Only interesting thing to come out of this research is...
One of the stats is interesting in the context of something we've been talking about a lot lately, the value gap.
The battle with YouTube.
Is that BuzzAngle reckons that in the first 6 months of this year, audio streams overtook video streams in terms of consumption. So they reckon there were 114 billion audio streams in the first 6 months and 95 billion video streams.
And of course, one thing that has been said in the whole sort of value gap, we hate YouTube debate in the last 18 months is the music industry is constantly making a distinction between how many streams are coming through on the video platforms, which basically means YouTube and I suppose Vevo, but most of Vevo's consumption is within YouTube anyway, versus the audio streams. And obviously, the thing that the record companies are always pushing forward is the phenomenal amount of streams that are going through the video platforms and particularly YouTube with relatively low royalties coming out the other end versus how many streams are happening on the audio platforms and then more money at the other end. So therefore, I suppose, to take what the music industry has been saying when it's doing down YouTube in recent months is you would assume the record companies and the publishers and the artists and songwriters, etc., would be pleased with the news that more streaming is now happening through the audio platforms than the video platforms because we make more money through the audio platforms than the video platforms. That said, we really make more money through the premium audio platforms, and that 114 billion includes all the freebie streams coming through, say, a Pandora or a Spotify freemium, which actually, although in the main they still pay better rates than YouTube because there'll probably be a minimum guarantee, which you don't get on YouTube, although nobody's that happy with the freebie audio rates either. It's the premium streams that people really, really appreciate.
But this report more focused on consumption. So they reckon that music consumption grew by 6% in the first half of the year.
Although that's
even though CD sales were down 11% and digital album sales were down 17%. And digital song sales were down 24%.
Yeah, so confirming that download sales are still slumping, I suppose, is the other key thing to come out of this. But having said that, that line is used a lot, particularly in the YouTube debate. Music consumption is at an all-time high. But what they mean is measurable music consumption is at an all-time high. Because obviously in the olden days, we would sell a CD. We weren't then counting every time somebody listened to the CD. And we weren't taking how many times songs got played on the radio and multiplying them by the number of listeners. So actually what's an all-time high is measurable consumption of music. But that line is brought out a lot, I mean, in this report, but in all the industry statements as well. Oh, music consumption is at an all-time high. And it's like, well, no. It doesn't necessarily mean people are listening to more music. It just means that consumption we can actually measure on a per-play basis is at an all-time high versus CDs that may have been listened to 82 billion times once a CD has been sold. That would be a lot of listening.
It would, wouldn't it?
That would probably take quite a long time.
That sort of links into a thing that YouTube's chief product officer, Neil Mohan, wrote for Billboard last week.
The latest attempt of YouTube to fight back.
So he was saying, there's all this talk about the value gap. What about the value shift?
Yes. The value gap wasn't tedious enough.
Trying to put a spin on it. But he was saying, I mean, in the US particularly, 80% of people are not big music fans who buy and pay for lots of music. They're not buying CDs. They're not paying for a premium subscription service. They're generally, historically, listening on the radio for free. That's how they get their radio. Those people are now starting to shift over, at least in part, to platforms like YouTube. And, I mean, in the US, you wouldn't get any royalties on the label side from radio play. But paraphrasing him, he was saying the royalties might be small on YouTube, but there's something versus the nothing you were previously getting, so please do stop complaining.
It was interesting, that op-ed piece in Billboard, because this comparing YouTube to radio never goes down well with the label's publishers. We knew that already. They always get pissed off when YouTube say, oh, just think of us like the new radio. We're a great marketing platform. We pay you nominal royalties compared to everybody else, but really we're the new radio. Radio always paid you nominal royalties. As you say, in the US, on the label side, they don't pay any royalties at all. But even here in the UK, where they do pay both the labels and the publishers money, overall they're nominal revenue streams. But think of the marketing. We're the new radio. Stop your moaning. But the labels and publishers have issued so many statements saying we don't accept that YouTube is the new radio because it's not. Because the YouTube experience is so similar to the Spotify free experience or the Deezer free experience, whereas the radio experience is very different to the CD experience. So we're not accepting that parallel. But his point, the value shift, the idea was, you might think that what we're paying is not very good, but we actually ultimately hand over about 65 to 70% of ad income. Whereas radio stations, even when they're paying, say in the US, it's unusual, they don't pay the labels anything. But when they do pay, they're usually paying single figure percent of their ad income over. So it was another attempt to say, we're not evil, but I don't think that article was going to win over any of the YouTube haters, of which there are many in the music community, and they've been shouting even more over the last 2 weeks.
Yes.
But anyway, to this research.
Yes, we've talked about the value gap enough. Let's look at who's popular.
Yes. So as well as telling us that CD sales are still down and that download sales were going down a lot, audio streams were booming. They also said that vinyl revival is still ongoing. So was it 17%?
17%. But still, that's 3 million sales.
Overall.
Over 6 months.
Still quite small part of the market. But nevertheless, they're still going up. But as well as that, they also had some stats about which artists have been the most streamed.
Yeah, so Work by Rihanna, that was the most streamed song of the year so far. And the most streamed album was Drake's latest. Rihanna came in third there. Justin Bieber keeping her and Drake apart.
Good. Sounds sensible.
Four was Bryson Tiller and five was Kevin Gates, who are apparently people.
But Adele's 25, which only went on streaming... well, since we've last been on the podcast, is that right? Because, of course, she kept her...
Yes,
her
so well, this, that's the thing. These stats go up to the 30th of June. Adele's album, 25, was only streaming...
For six days. Of the 6 months.
So they've added her in, but that's why she doesn't appear in the top five, whereas you would probably expect her to. She does appear. She's the second highest selling album of the year, but she only gets 6 days worth of streaming stats in here, but she still managed to be streamed 168 million times.
And bearing in mind, this is just US figures.
Yeah.
So finally having arrived on the streaming platforms, and despite selling so many records, she is doing very well on there.
Yes, the end of the year, I would expect Adele's album to be top of the streaming tree. That seems like a reasonable bet. Although she is currently only, as I said, the second highest seller of the year in the US. She's very slightly behind Views by Drake, which is the biggest seller of the year so far.
Bearing in mind, Adele's album came out last year. So you're making that sound like...
I know, but 21 was the biggest selling album of the year for about 15 years
true.
In a row, wasn't
it's
it?
It's true. So Drake is ruining all of Adele's dreams.
She is, it is. I mean, when I say slightly behind, she's very slightly behind. It's quite close still.
So some interesting stats there. And I suppose anything that is showing more consumption coming through the audio streaming platforms, and particularly the pay-for platforms, so Spotify and Apple Music and Tidal, etc., will be good news for the music industry, because that is where all the growth is in terms of revenue. So let's see if that optimistic news is reflected in the end of year stats that we get from the record industry at the end of this year or actually early next year. Perhaps audio paid for streaming is finally taking off. We're going to get enough paying subscribers that everyone will go into profit. The labels will all be super happy again. And then finally, everyone can stop banging on about YouTube all the time. I can't wait for that moment when audio streaming comes of age and then we can just forget about the fact that YouTube over here is sort of taking the piss.
Yeah, but there'll be something else.
There'll be something else.
There's always something else. Anyway, until that time, more YouTube complaining for the time being, but some positive stats nonetheless. Just quickly, time to look through a few of the stories that we've not had time to talk about this
very quickly because I've got places to be.
Guevara, I think since we last spoke about Guevara, which we've done twice on recent podcasts, put two of its companies in administration and began a PR offensive to counteract negative stories about it in the press.
So a bit of a running story, been quite a few updates on CB Daily in the last week. I'm sure there'll be several more updates to come in the weeks
as
to
we
come.
Record this, there is a creditors meeting going on.
In Australia.
At which we should get a clearer plan of what the future for Guevara is. Sticking with streaming, Ardio, Ardio are definitely dead streaming service.
It doesn't have any future.
Has hit back at Sony Music this week with allegations of anti-competitive behaviour.
So Sony, as we may or may not have talked about on the podcast, can't remember, are suing three former executives at Ardio. Ardio went into bankruptcy last year, selling most of its assets for $75 million to Pandora. Sony are claiming that Ardio misled Sony in the run-up to that bankruptcy. And now Sony is one of, if not the biggest, unsecured creditor of Ardio, desperately trying to get as much of that $75 million as it can. So Sony began legal action earlier this year, and now Ardio are fighting back with their own litigation, accusing Sony Music of being anti-competitive in the way that it does its digital deals because of the most favoured nation clauses, which are in pretty much every digital deal.
Which was sort of what Sony said in its own response.
So be interesting to see whether or not that has any mileage whatsoever.
Sticking with bankruptcy, look at the way these all feed onto each other. A court has approved a deal over 50 Cent's bankruptcy.
So he declared himself bankrupt a year ago, almost to the day, and he's finally agreed to pay his creditors up to about 90% of what he owes them over the next five years.
I mean, it appeared that he proclaimed himself to be bankrupt to get out of paying damages in a court case, which has backfired because he has to pay $6 million in that. So
he has seemingly shaved $1 million off in the bankruptcy negotiations, so maybe not so much of a disaster. Anyway, hopefully,
still quite a lot of money, though,
by the end of the year, 50 Cent will no longer be bankrupt.
There's a new digital economy bill.
Yeah, another one.
To go with the last
one. Doesn't seem 2 minutes since the last one. So this is another bit of legislation the UK government are putting to Parliament, assuming that Parliament's still going to be open.
Who knows? I think just
I don't know what's going on. But anyway,
shut the whole thing down.
They've written this bit of legislation like the Digital Economy Act of 2010. It's a mishmash piece of legislation trying to amend various bits of law in relation to internet stuff. The bit of relevance to the music industry is that they are planning on increasing the potential penalties for running an online copyright infringing business to be in tandem with the prison sentences that you can get for doing basically a bootleg CD or DVD operation. So up to 10 years. I think at the moment 3 years is about the maximum. Of course, this leads to loads of articles about how file sharers are going to be locked up for 10 years for sharing. But it's aimed at people. It's criminal level copyright infringement. So you have to be running quite a serious online infringement operation to be affected by this. But sentences will go up, assuming this ever works its way through Parliament.
And staying online, a new museum, an online museum, archiving Prince's many websites has opened. They have 12 websites of 20 archived so far.
As you said,
dating back to 1994.
As you said in your little article reporting on this, Prince sort of became known almost as being a bit of a Luddite in that he often clamped down on where his music was available digitally. He was very big on the takedown, stopping his music being shared. Although that sometimes makes you forget, actually, Prince was one of the massive innovators when it came to websites. Certainly in the 90s, when everybody else hadn't even got a web page.
Yeah, he had his own subscription service.
Yeah, he had his own social network, basically, didn't he? So Prince did a lot of interesting stuff online from very early on, and this is a project to archive all of that posthumously so that fans can go and relive what Prince was doing online back in the day.
Yeah, so to read about all of those in full, go to the show notes for this episode of the CMU podcast at completemusicupdate.com/podcast. And finally this week, some good old beefing.
Yeah, a bit of a beef of the week. Is this going to be beef of the week?
Could be.
It could be. Not yet picked beef of the week.
No.
So this isn't artists beefing, not pop stars beefing. This is digital music services.
I mean, we've seen basically YouTube pitted against the audio streaming services of late.
By the music companies.
This is audio streaming on audio streaming violence.
And it is executives from two of the leading streaming services having a public slanging match. To be fair, I think Spotify are doing more of this in public than Apple.
Yes.
Because Apple's was done through a legal letter. Although the fact that it got published quite so quickly suggests that they did leak it to the media.
Yeah.
So give us the background to this squabble.
The background is that this US Senator Elizabeth Warren last week criticised Apple for conditions on its rivals that make it difficult for them to offer competitive streaming services.
This was part of a speech about how some of the American tech giants... So she looked at Google, she talked about Amazon and Apple, saying that how some of the American tech giants sometimes arguably exploit their size to the detriment of startups. And she was saying these are incredibly successful American companies. They deserve to make a lot of money on their success. We're pleased that they are so big and so successful. But they should remember that in relative recent history, they were startups too, and that they shouldn't go stamping around their market dominance to stop startups from succeeding. And she gave different examples for Google and Amazon, and given the whole YouTube thing, didn't mention that when she was criticising Google. It was Apple where she specifically mentioned streaming services, which made the rest of us assume that she was alluding to the whole Apple tax thing, of which Spotify has been quite vocal on in the last year.
Yes, and we've mentioned this before on the podcast, but it's basically the practice. If you want to sell something through an app on iOS, you have to pay Apple a 30% cut of any money you make, which is a problem for the streaming services because they already give away 70% of their revenue.
Yeah, actually more, but more so. Ideally,
but ideally 70%. And so that means they'd be giving up 100% of their revenue. So if you sign up for Spotify through your iPhone, you have to pay £13 a month rather than £10 a month because Spotify passed that 30% cost on to you, the customer.
And although that is also the case with the Android App Store, with the Google App Store, Google allow people to tell their customers, because you can be an iOS user and have a Spotify subscription on £10 a month. It's just that you have to do the actual transaction through Spotify's website and then use your passwords to log in on the app. You can't do the transaction through the app. So that's possible, but Apple's rules not only force the 30% commission, they also say that Spotify can't explain that in the app. So they're not allowed to say, as people are going to sign up, hang on, this is a really silly way to sign up to our service. You should go to Spotify.com where it's £3 a month cheaper. Which also means, obviously, since Apple entered the streaming market itself just over a year ago, that if you are subscribing through the App Store, it appears that Apple Music is cheaper than Spotify.
Yes.
When, of course, if you went to Spotify.com, they are exactly the same price in most markets.
And Apple recently dropped the fee, actually, to 15%, but Spotify and that lot aren't happy still.
Yeah,
they're still pretty much giving away 100% of their revenues.
And indeed, the 15% doesn't kick in until after a year of a subscriber being subscribed. So you've still got a year of losing all that money. And when that happened and everyone went to Spotify for some comment, Spotify said, well, it's just a gesture, isn't it? We're still having to give them far too much money. Oh, and by the way, we've got all these other complaints about the app platform within iOS and how it's stopping us from reaching our consumers and expanding this experience. We hate Apple. So that all happened before Elizabeth Warren made her comments. And then at the same time as that being in the news, it emerged that Spotify's most recent upgrade of their app had been rejected by Apple. Because if you have an app available through iOS, every time it upgrades, you have to get it cleared by Apple, who have all these rules. And apparently the latest incarnation Spotify app doesn't comply with Apple rules, so they had it knocked back. And that resulted in a bit more bickering between the two tech companies.
Yes, so this has kind of been going back and forth for the last, well, since Elizabeth Warren's speech. So after that, Spotify's Jonathan Prince, who's their, is he their international comms guy now?
He's their chief comms man.
Yeah. He said, Apple has long used its control of iOS to squash competition in music, driving up the prices of its competitors inappropriately, forbidding us from telling our customers about lower prices and giving itself unfair advantages across its platform.
And then with regards to the fact that the new version of the app hadn't been approved by Apple, Spotify then said it was
causing grave harm to Spotify and its customers.
So this is where Apple then responded. This was a legal letter that they sent to the Spotify's in-house lawyer, although it did manage to find its way onto BuzzFeed,
yes.
I think.
So Apple's lawyer, Bruce Sewell, said to Spotify, "We find it troubling that you are asking for exemptions to the rules we apply to all developers and are publicly resorting to rumours and half-truths about our service. Our guidelines apply equally to all app developers, whether they are game developers, ebook sellers, video streaming services, or digital music distributors, and regardless of whether or not they compete against Apple." So they're just saying, hey, look, this is just a thing. You shouldn't worry about it, even though it's bad for your business.
Well, obviously, they're annoyed that Spotify are hitting out at Apple, and they're basically saying, we apply rules to everybody. The fact you're a competitor is irrelevant, so stop implying that we're being particularly bad to you because we want people to sign up to Apple Music and not Spotify.
But then Jonathan Prince, him again, hit back at that, tweeting a screen grab of the Spotify app that had been rejected, saying, this is what Apple wants you to believe violates their rules. No offer, no purchase, no link anywhere at all, referring to the rules that you're not allowed to promote, that you've got lower prices.
So a bit of backwards and forwards between the two services. The other rumour that has been circulating since we last did a podcast is that Apple is in talks to buy Tidal.
Now, because everyone's been in talks to buy Tidal at some point.
Now, I think Tidal have officially denied this, which probably means they'll sell to Apple next week. That's usually what a denial means, isn't it? The rumour is that Apple have been impressed with those big exclusives that Jay-Z has managed to score from, many from artists he manages. So I don't know how impressive that is. So I don't know whether that is true. I mean, there would be a certain logic, actually, to Apple Music taking on Tidal. Quite how they would then merge the products, I'm not sure. But obviously, I mean, at the last count, Tidal, we reckon, have got about 4.5 million users because they keep adding people with those exclusives. So adding that to Apple Music, I mean, Spotify would still be quite a bit ahead in terms of paying users, but it would help Apple Music make a bit of a leap in its bid to outperform Spotify as premium streamers. So, hey, we love a bit of beefing. Long may it continue. I want Tim Cook, also no relation. Does he have an E? I don't think he does he?
Well, he dropped it to distance himself from
himself
your family.
From me. We want Tim Cook on the Twitters, and then Daniel Ek, we want it backwards and forwards. Because this, nothing much happens in the music industry in the summer. It would be good if there was lots of bickering between Apple and
this.
Spotify to keep things going. Not that we're going to be here in podcast form to talk about this bickering for the next few weeks.
No, we're taking the summer off.
We're having a summer break. Now, some of you might say, hang on a second, you had a break quite recently. But that was our May break, and this is our summer break. They are entirely different breaks. But
should be said, we're not having a break. A break break.
You're having a break from the podcast. Although you are going on holiday next week.
All right, you went to Barbados. It's not.
I was working. It was very hard work
in
Barbados.
It's not a competition.
I worked the entire time I was there.
Did you?
That was definitely work.
I don't know about
but
that.
But I would quite like to go back there to do more work. So we've got no podcast for the next few weeks. We will be back, we think, in mid-August.
Yeah.
But if you want updates on what is happening with the podcast, you should sign up to CMU Daily at completemusicupdate.com/sign up, because we will keep you up to date with podcasts. He there, Andy Moll, is talking about doing something special over the summer. So we can all place bets on whether or not that happens. Do you think that's going to happen?
Some yeah, it might do.
Special extra editions. So, of course, the other way that you would absolutely never miss out on anything that we put out podcast-wise, beyond signing up to See Me Daily, which you should all do, is to properly subscribe to the podcast, rather than just listening to it on the website or on SoundCloud or Mixcloud, which are all great platforms. But if you signed up to us through iTunes or your podcast app of choice, then the minute we podcast anything, people still use podcast as a verb. Can we still say to podcast?
Yes.
Is that still a thing people say?
Yeah.
The minute we podcast anything, you would be the first to hear it. But yeah, we're not going to be here for a few weeks in podcast form. You'll have to read our stuff instead. Sorry for fans of listening rather than reading. You will have to read.
Use some text-to-voice software. It would be very similar.
Perhaps we could start doing that. Could be the podcast. We'll just run a CMU Daily through some of that software.
Maybe that's what the special editions will be.
That's what the special editions will be. I look forward to it.
Well, good. Well, as Chris says, do subscribe to the podcast and you can rate and review it. You've got time now to really consider your review.
And you can go back through past editions. If you haven't listened to the David Lowery interview, definitely do.
Do, yes.
There was those interviews
Even
I did,
though I wasn't on it, it was very good.
There was those interviews I did earlier in the year at the Convergence Festival.
Yes.
Which we put out on a podcast with some very interesting music media people. That's still there in the archive. If you want to, you can go back to the first iteration of the podcast, way back when.
Yeah, and you could do that. I mean, people do, an alarming number of people do.
Talking
I need to
about,
go back and see what those sound like.
I don't know, the collapse of EMI or Mega Upload shutdown.
Pick a story, we probably talked about it.
So perhaps you could go and relive 2011. Perhaps we could just re-podcast some of those.
Some classics.
Classic editions. Podcast gold. Perhaps that's what we'll do.
Maybe. Well, we'll see. Anyway, until then, my name is...
I find the idea of seeing your podcast gold very funny, but there you go. I look forward to returning with new podcasts later in the year.
My name
yeah.
is Andy Malt. His name is Chris Cook. Look at that. I've missed the E of your
Have
name
you?
In the notes.
So perhaps
you're,
I am related.
You're distancing yourself from your family.
Perhaps I am related to Tim Cook. After
and
all.
Now all the listeners know that I have to write this stuff down every week or I completely forget what I say. Anyway, Chris Cook with an E. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an Unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Well, that sounded fine. Don't know what you were worried about.